You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining out
door. Come over here, kid, where's up? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic.
It's
then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. And you got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
Potatoes, yeah.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay on there, stay on there, stay on there.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. I'm Michelle Jordan. How are you doing this evening? Did you have a nice day? I loved the weather here today. It was so fall-like, almost winter-like, and it just made me feel very reclusive. So I did all kinds of things in my house that I might not otherwise have done. It was fun. I hope this next hour is going to be fun as well. I'm very excited about our guest, someone I did a little bit of work with a number of years ago when he had the most delightful restaurant. Terrible location, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm.
It is Paul Ahrenstam. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
That sweet little place was called Balon.
Right.
And being a great fan of the Balon oyster, I noticed it immediately.
Sure. Well, it was certainly was a labor of love. And I think being a chef with ambition and a passion for cooking, but a little naive in the ways of how restaurants work, it was the outcome I would have chose to be different, but it certainly was a lot of fun while it lasted.
Mm-hmm. The problem was right there in the tenderloin. No way you could, on the edge, but still, it was the tenderloin.
Well, if you remember, it was when we opened in 99 or late 99, the area people thought of, as it was the height of the dot-com. Every area of the city was thought to be up and coming, including the tenderloin. And my partners thought, can't miss with this location. You're right in the middle of the city. You're a block from Union Square, the cable car. It'll be great. So it just didn't turn out to be that way. So
yeah, the dot-com crashed.
Well, yeah, I think when we closed, or in the spring of 2001, I think, if people remember, the stock market started taking a dip, and the classic story, just didn't have enough funds and to weather a storm. And we closed in June of 2001, and I think obviously by September of that year, we would have definitely had to close, given the circumstances. So.
Sure. And it was obviously the emphasis was seafood, Balon.
Yeah, it was really the idea was a great. I mean, San Francisco has such a great history with seafood and shellfish, and I thought, what a great thing to have a wide variety of oysters and shellfish. And I loved the spirit of that brasserie feel with the conviviality of the dining. The food was straightforward and I think honest and true to its roots. And I think it resonated with people. And, it wasn't anything out of the ordinary to me, but people still stop me today and have fond memories of it.
Oh, good, good. Well, I've always thought that San Francisco, in not just San Francisco, but the California coast in general, we should have more seafood restaurants.
Yeah.
It's an ocean
yeah.
right there. And it's not, you don't have that same sense that you do on the East Coast.
Yeah, I find that, you know, somewhat true. It's hard, and I don't know why that is. I mean, people love seafood here as much as anywhere mm-hmm. else, and they certainly would come. But you don't have that sort of quintessential feel that you might get back east. I was just back a couple of weeks ago on vacation, and you know,
where'd you go?
I was Cape Cod. I grew up in the Boston area, so I was uh-huh. with family on the Cape, the typical summer. But you know, that feel of just sort of plain and or simple, I guess, is the way to say it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think
simple.
It's sometimes hard to find that here, and maybe because in the city, at least, those kind of restaurants are all sort of in Fisherman's Wharf or at Fisherman's Wharf, and I think locals don't tend to find themselves down that area town.
Yeah, we still have Swan Oyster Depot.
Yeah.
But it closes uh-huh. at 5.
And you have to wait on the sidewalk for the
Yes, you have to wait. If you get there after if you get there after 10:30, you have to wait for an hour outside.
Right, right. Yeah.
So it's one of my favorite places for breakfast. where are you now?
Currently I'm at the Hotel Vitale in Americano. Newer boutique hotel, restaurant right on the Embarcadero across from the ferry building.
One of the things that is so great about that location, especially these days, I think, is that from the North Bay, you can just drive down to the Larkspur Ferry.
Right, uh-huh.
You can take the ferry over, get off, have dinner, get back on the ferry.
Yeah, our managing director of the hotel lives in Sausalito, and he comes to work via the ferry, and mm-hmm. he loves it, so...
Yeah, between the price of gas and the price of parking.
Yeah, and that toll is going up.
Oh, right, yes. And then there's the toll.
Yeah.
So tell me about the restaurant.
We're an Italian-inspired restaurant. We don't have a particular singular focus on any region within Italy, mm-hmm. But using the market as our guide, and I think having a sort of Italian with an accent, we're sort of the spirit of that farm-to-table cooking that you find extensively through Italy. You know, we just cook with the seasons, and I don't think that's unique, but I think given our location and our proximity to the farmers market, we have a great vantage point to watch the seasons go by.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are real involved in the upcoming Slow Food Nation.
Mm-hmm.
It originally asked you to be on because of your Starlight Supper.
Sure.
And we are going to talk about that, but that has sold out.
It is. Our Starlight Supper, we're calling it, is our there's a series of dinners that are taking place over the Labor Day weekend in conjunction with Slow Food Nation. Our dinner is benefits our nonprofit partner, the Golden Gate National Parks Conservancy. And it's a al fresco supper outside on our wonderful patio overlooking the Bay Bridge and the ferry building.
Of the restaurant?
So the restaurant is we have 50 or 60 seats. And then our big attraction is because of our location is a very casual, it's like an upscale backyard. We have bamboo and large picnic tables, but they're sort of finished nicely, and it's a nice environment. So we're going to turn that into a really nice, intimate outdoor space for the dinner, and we've got some great partners coming in to help us out. My friend Chris Cosentino and his wonderful salumi there at Boccolone, he's going to come mm-hmm. in with his slicer and do some of his artisan meats, and we have our friends from Heritage Foods in New York, which will come and supply some of the meats as well.
Chris Cosentino, I want to write his name down. So what is do you know the menu by heart by any chance?
I think I do, yeah. we'll have a reception. Chris will, again, his salumi and other artisan meats that he produces now with his shop there at the Ferry Building. Let's see, the first course we're doing, and very simple, we're thinking of it as a sort of elegant backyard sort of dinner. Tomatoes with Gioia Burrata, which is a wonderful cheese produced down in Southern California. A Sicilian-style fish stew, second course. Our friends at Hearst Ranch, we're going to do their skirt steak with Anson Mills polenta. And finally, a summer berry pudding.
Mm-hmm.
So we're thinking of all the wonderful things mm-hmm. that we use and incorporate in the restaurant already and kind of showcasing them just for the evening, for the slow food dinner.
Uh-huh. Sounds like a perfect menu. Sounds like how I cook at home, actually.
It should be a lot of fun.
Polenta and skirt steak is one of my favorite things. Uh-huh. And I did want to mention, because we're talking about slow food, if you're listening outside the area on podcast, or if you're listening now on real time, I did a column in the Press Democrat that came out this last Wednesday, and it's now available online at the Press Democrat website. That's pressdemocrat.org, and it's about slow food. And I took inspiration from my conversation with Alice Waters, broadcast here on Mouthful 2 weeks ago, where she went, I think intuitively, I don't think this was planned, she just went right up against the, I think, intuitive resistance that people have to slow food, which is, I'm feeding my family, I don't have time for it. It's that slow equals luxury, mm-hmm. in the way a lot of people think about food today, when actually what she was saying was you can get food on, should be getting dinner on the table at home in 10 minutes in the summer.
Well, I think that's really important, and I can sort of speak from experience as a parent of a four-year-old. The last thing that I want to do is spend a lot of time cooking, and that's not any different than any other parent. Yeah. The idea of slow food and Slow Food Nation to me is not a restaurant idea. So as a restaurant chef...
It's so important to say that again. That's a really important thing.
But, no, it is. I mean, it really is not a movement about chefs or restaurants. It happens to be an idea that I think resonates with chefs, certainly with me. But it's not based about the culture of chefs or recently the celebrity of chefs. So... it's about Hana's food, really wonderful, great food, simply done, and presenting it. I think the other element that has always attracted me is the sense of the table as a place to gather and meet and learn about people. And through food, from my own experience, has always been I've met some wonderful people all around a dinner table, and some are still friends today. And I think that's the thing that connects me to slow food is that idea of the spirit of the table.
I completely agree with you. You're listening to Mouthful. We're talking with Paul Ehrenstam, executive chef of Americana Restaurant and father of a four-year-old. It's Mouthful. Where else would you hear Per Ubu during a food and wine talk show, huh? Coming up really soon, I want to tell you, we're revamping the KRCB website. And I know that 2 weeks ago, I sent you there for the recipe of the week. And there was a little technical glitch. It's still going to happen. And it will happen sometime soon. But the tech dudes probably, and tech dudes and girls, need a little bit more time to get that set up. So we will definitely be letting you know. And at the same time, I want to start yet another new tradition that we list the songs that we've played on each episode of Mouthful. So if you want to check that out, you can. And we'll also be listing the book that Laura Hager, our book critic, is reviewing and try to get a cover shot as well. And who knows, maybe we'll even get so technically proficient, we'll have some in-studio shots for you. We're talking to Paul Ehrenstam, executive chef at Hotel Vitale, an Americana restaurant, and very involved with Slow Food and the upcoming Slow Food Nation. You going to be doing anything else for those 3 days?
I am. The weekend will consist of an opening dinner on the Thursday night, which I'll be attending. And then Friday is a day they call Change Makers Day. A lot of academics and policymakers will get together and discuss some of the issues of the day regarding food. So for me, that's more of a a spectator and to hopefully learn a little bit more about some of the things that are at the core of slow food. So that's Friday. Saturday, the Taste Pavilions are taking place down at Fort Mason. There's the Victory Garden in the Civic Center area. Slow on the Go are some inexpensive bites, showcasing some of the ingredients that are...
Now, Slow on the Go, that part I don't know so much
Slow
about.
On the Go, I think it's the idea is more so sort of street food.
Oh, okay, street food.
Based...
A favorite on Mouthful.
Hopefully inexpensive and trying to underscore the message that it's food for everyone and it's not... highbrow sort of cuisine that even, you know, hamburgers and, and such can be featured. So, and then Sunday is our dinner, and then the closing day on Sunday, we'll be hosting, I think, a party for the organizers. So it's going to be a busy weekend for me. I'm looking forward to it.
Will your four-year-old be involved?
You know, I'll probably take him over to the Taste Pavilion. Some of it will require me to be sort of at work and but I'm sure we'll have him involved in some way when we over at the Fort Mason.
Have you been able to translate your involvement, or not so much your involvement, your feelings about food to him? What's his name?
Theo. Four-year-old, and. You know, it's a good question. I think we cook together and
you okay,
know,
there
the,
you go.
In the morning that could mean eggs and he wants to crack the eggs and whip the eggs and food is in our family. My wife, Charlene, was a former pastry chef at Chez Panisse for many years. And so we were sort of, we came to, we found each other because we were in the business. So only sort of two people in the business could understand what it takes to have a relationship. And there's a lot of people like that, I think,
yeah,
in this business.
Yeah, I know that, a number of them.
That the their partner is also in the business. So, no, but he's really, he's curious and he's he has a typical four-year-old appetite. There are certain things he doesn't like, but if we eat it, he tends to eat it too.
That's so great. That's just such great news.
Yeah.
And it seems like there's a fair amount of that lately, where a few years ago it seemed like there was this real division. Adults had their adult food and they would make kids' food for the kids and sort of feed them off somewhere else.
Yeah, no, we don't do that. And a lot of times for us is just we might add we might have a reward system, and I know a lot of parents will know that sometimes that works, is that, you know, if you eat this, there might be something in it for you later on, something sweet. So that tends to work for us, and it broadens the sort of foods that he'll eat, and we're happy that he has that.
Does he like sitting at the table? Does he like being at the table?
Very much so. You know,
yeah, I think that's one of the most important things.
You know, we try to make that a part of our routine as much as we can. And also when we go out to eat, we don't go to upscale restaurants with him, but we certainly go to restaurants that, you know, you have to have appropriate behavior. So, we make it a point that if he's having a challenging day, that the day ends pretty quickly. We don't torture other patrons nearby with our four-year-old and his emotions of the day.
Yes, I've spoken like someone in the restaurant business, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I've had many of those days. back at your restaurant, at Americana Restaurant, you said that the patio has big picnic tables. Do you do family-style seating? Do you seat strangers with strangers?
We sort of do. The restaurant itself, it's more of a an outdoor lounge, and it's been one of the challenges that we've had, or I've had as the chef, is trying to attract. We have, it's a boutique hotel. We're at the heart of the financial district. We're right across from the street from the Embarcadero, so we attract an after work crowd. So some of them that who come are not necessarily interested in the food. So part of what I try to do is introduce things that maybe they're not paying attention, but I feel really confident that if they were, they would be, you know, if they're part of that food culture, they would, it would be part, it would all make sense. The Inoteca menu, which is what we call it, is served on the patio. So there are things that are meant to be shared and eaten out of hand and that work well with cocktails and you know, it's just more of a casual approach rather than the dining room, which is a more of a traditional sit-down arrangement.
And What was I going to say? Oh, I remember this one time I was over at Oliveto. I've told the story so many times, but it was a really pivotal experience for me. This was in 1991, and they were trying something called a la tavola.
Mm-hmm.
And family style, fixed price, you sit whoever you sit with, and you share food. They serve things on big platters. I still remember exactly what I ate.
Right.
And I drove all the way down from Sebastopol to Oakland to go to that. And then I wrote about it, and I absolutely loved it. And as you would expect, everyone at the table, and we eventually all talked to each other, we knew, you know, we had people that we knew in common. There's 1 degree of separation was all. But it was an utter failure. It lasted 4 weeks, 6 weeks. No one, I mean, even people coming into the restaurant, they wanted to sit by themselves and order off the menu. They didn't want to join in that family style. So I've always thought of Maggie Klein as being really prescient, at that, really being, you know, a good decade or more ahead of the curve. And mm-hmm. I keep hoping that there's going to be somebody who really sets that concept on fire, because I really love it.
Yeah, for us, you know, people might share a table, but it might not necessarily be about the food. It might be about an attraction to each other rather than the food. So, I could see why that doesn't work sometimes, because people sort of have a preconceived idea that they like their space and that they want to order. And the idea of not knowing or not having control of what I'm going to eat can be daunting for some. And as opposed to the idea that, don't worry, whoever's making this is really good, and you're going to be grateful that when you have it, when it comes, it's going to be wonderful.
Like this is how things are done.
Yeah,
it's one of the things I like about riding the train.
Yeah.
Even though you do have a limited menu that you can order from, you sit where they tell you to sit.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're traveling, you know, alone or with one other person, you are going to be seated with people that you don't know, and you will get to know them throughout the course of, you know, one meal or a few meals if you're traveling a distance.
Well, it sounds great, and also it might not be the greatest restaurant model, you know, financially, that people, it might be somewhat flawed in that sense too. So I could see why probably it ended.
Maybe one night a week.
Well,
community dinner. See, my idea is that everyone on Monday night, neighborhood restaurants do community dinner.
I think that's great.
You come in at 6 o'clock, or you come in at 8 o'clock. You bring the kids. There's one price. There's platters. There's two jugs of wine, one red, one white, and a jug of milk. And Monday, because that's a hard day for parents to cook.
I was trying to have that very idea at our slowest night of the week is Sunday. The occupancy of the hotel is the lowest on Sundays, as people leave for the weekend, and then our business clientele can arrive on Monday. So as a way to try to drive that, I had the idea of having this really affordable, fun, great food, but simply done in a family style. And it just, I think the idea was met with a little bit of skepticism, because it didn't have a certain luxury that the hotel sort of needed. So we ended up not going
not
with that
it.
Idea. But I always love that idea, because, that restaurant up here, Ad Hoc, over in Napa, I just love what they do. They have those, the menus, and you call, and you're not quite sure what you get, or until the day of, and it's a great value.
Yeah, and you just, like you say, you trust the restaurant. You know the restaurant makes good food.
Yeah.
You just go in, they feed you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think there's, to some degree, that's also a European there's certainly small restaurants in France and Italy where you go in, they sit you wherever, and they feed you. You don't have any choices.
Yeah, and maybe your mind is in a different place because you're traveling or you're more willing, but sometimes there's other circumstances, at least we find, people might be coming for a business dinner or the idea of allergies, which is, I'm sure everybody seems to be allergic these days to food.
So you're still seeing a lot of that in the restaurant?
Yeah, you know.
What form are the allergies taking these days?
What did we have the other day? Somebody was allergic to, it escapes me at the moment, but I was like, fine, we'll come up with something. But to me, I think the idea for, there's legitimate allergies, let's face it. I mean, people are really...
there are a few legitimate food
allergies. I mean, our son, when he was born, he had a dairy allergy that he outgrew. So it was soy for his first year, which was difficult for my wife, because she was now on a dairy-free diet as well, because she was nursing.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, at least for dairy. So, but people, I think, legitimize their allergies to restaurants, so we have to sort of make a lot of changes and exceptions. And I think people want to at least I know, I'm very accommodating. Mm-hmm. I don't have an absolute rule that I know I won't do this if this will make the guests happy.
I think most restaurants I've ever seen are accommodating.
Yeah, I mean, it's in our interest to be accommodating. Mm-hmm. It's not about challenging people and telling them they can't have what they want. But I've definitely, the point being is I've seen a lot more of it in the last 5 or 10 years than I did when I was first starting out.
I started noticing it in the early 90s. Particularly with people from Marin County. And it wasn't so much framed as allergy at that point. It was framed as, I can't have. And there was a lot of, I can't have. And it's like, I can't have any fat.
Do we broadcast in Marin County?
Yeah, we do.
We do. Okay.
It's okay. Right. Well, we do. You know, they have to listen online.
No offense to Marin County.
But I mean, that's just where it started.
Right.
I mean, partly I was reviewing restaurants. Sometimes I would review restaurants there. But I would notice dinner guests or people at the table, there was that, I can't have. And that seemed to go hand in hand with, oh, you still use alcohol?
Right.
It's like, no, actually, I drink wine. I'm not using alcohol. So I noticed that. And then I think I noticed a number of years ago, it started morphing into, I'm allergic to.
Yeah, and it could be other, you know, people want to avoid those things. So if they
say allergy.
Right, they frame it as an allergy. It's more of a medical condition than a dislike.
They can't yell at you.
Right.
I figured that out when I was 5 years old.
Yeah.
And I was in kindergarten and I went through my first lunch line and I had a hot dog and there was mustard on it. And I didn't like French's mustard.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat there and I looked at it and I cried. And somehow I got up the idea that I would just go tell them I was allergic to mustard and they would give me a plain hot dog. And they did.
Isn't that great?
So, you know, I don't know how I figured that out when I was 5, but I did. But I see adults do that a lot. And if you press them, if they're a good enough friend, I'll say, you're allergic to, you know, salt? Really? I didn't know anyone could be allergic to an inorganic item like salt. Well, actually, I just don't like to eat too much.
Exactly.
So, it's sort of amusing. There was an interesting article in Harper's, I think, just a couple months ago about this whole idea of food allergies and how there's actually an organization that promotes the prevention of allergic reactions to food. And they have been fueling the hysteria for the last 5 or 6 years. And they quoted some statistics about how many kids, for example, actually are allergic to peanuts versus, you know, how many parents think their kids are.
Right.
And there was that girl, you probably remember, just a few years ago, the girl who supposedly died after kissing her boyfriend because he ate peanuts.
Right.
You never get the follow-up to that. She had an asthma attack and died, and it had nothing to do with peanuts.
No, I never heard the end result.
That's what this article in Harper's had, all kinds of stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're back to a time of food allergies, which is more annoying, food allergies or fat phobia? Maybe food allergies is the way to go.
Yeah. That part of it is, I just think it's about common sense and moderation on that side of it. I do know I'd rather have real fat, butter and olive oil than something.
Hallelujah.
And as you get older, it changes a little bit and you have to be more mindful. I'm certainly getting to that point where I have to think about it. But the payoff is definitely worth it if you can somehow think of it as the once in a while it's instead of eliminating entirely, just once in a while have it and really enjoy it. I think that's the way to go.
Yeah, well, I'm a great fan of healthy fat.
Yeah,
and actually we're going off so many little alleyways.
Yeah.
I was reading about another long-term study on diet and people. People who had a higher percentage of fat in their diet, but were still trying to lose weight, were more successful at both losing and keeping the weight off than people who ate a low-fat diet.
Hmm, that's interesting.
I think it's because fat serves a purpose. It satisfies you.
Yeah, uh-huh. You feel full?
Yeah, you feel full and you feel happy.
Well, I know there's moments that you do, that's for sure.
Yes, nothing like perfect butter. Speaking of moments of happiness, I just have to tell you something I had to eat last night. Because it was a profound moment of happiness. For a long time, I would come to San Francisco, and I'm not going to remember the name of the restaurant, but you might. It's in the little alleyway there where B-44, you know.
That's Belden. Belden Lane.
Belden Lane, yeah. And there's the French restaurant towards the end. I think it's next to Plouf, and yes. It's made like a metro stop.
Right, and I...
What is it? It's not Metro.
Cafe Bastille, is it?
Cafe Bastille. I knew you would know. Cafe Bastille. I used to drive from here to Cafe Bastille because they had bones on the menu. Mm-hmm. Roasted bones.
With marrow.
Bone marrow, yeah. Mm-hmm. Some bones, some bone marrow, a little bit of greens, and a little ramekin of salt. And that was the first place I'd seen it in this country. I'm sure they had it in New York and stuff, but I didn't know anywhere else that had it. So I'd go down there, you know, every couple months. Well, the new restaurant's opened in Sonoma County, Eloise.
Mm-hmm.
And it's where, for people who know Sonoma County well, it's where Chez Peo and then more recently Bistro V were. So I went last night for the first time. They've been open about 3 weeks. And they're from the husband and wife team who run it are from New York. And I knew that I was going to get bone marrow because they told me they were going to have bone marrow on the menu. And it comes with three very large bones.
Mm-hmm.
This is the most extraordinary bone marrow I've ever had.
Sure.
And they're selling a lot of it.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. We have it on our menu.
Oh, you do? Excellent.
We have it as a garnish to, we're doing a hanger steak.
Oh, so you do it as a garnish.
It's a garnish that comes with some grilled bread and sea salt and roasted garlic. And it just, you know, people love it. And think of it as a spread, you know, just instead of putting butter on your toast. Mm-hmm.
You just take out that hot bone marrow, spread it on the bread and sprinkle it with a little bit of, I think they're using, at Eloise, I think they're using Malden sea salt. That's what it looked like.
That's what we used to.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's perfect. Mm-hmm. So that is just, the most delicious thing I've had in a really long time. It's Mouthful. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. It is a KRCB. Thanks for sticking with us. My guest this evening, Paul Ehrenstam. You can find Paul's recipe for very good mussels meunière and outstanding French fries in my book, San Francisco Seafood. That is where we met back in, 1999.
Maybe 2000 when we opened. So,
yeah, it came out in 2000. So,
yep.
Yeah, it was. Oh, you opened in 2000?
We opened the first, I remember it was January of 2000, so one of the first restaurants of the
Okay, so the book must have come out in 2001.
Yeah.
Don't know my own kids anymore.
my memory is getting a little cloudy, too.
I haven't looked at that book in a long time. Anyway, great recipe for mussels, and I think you also did a recipe for skate wing.
Because
we
did,
we made that together. That was a really good lesson you gave me in boning skate wing, and it was fabulous skate wing.
Yeah, I love that dish, and it's a shame that skate has become somewhat of a endangered fish as well. So, like most of the species these days, that was a great dish.
Mm-hmm. What sort of seafood are you working with these days at the restaurant?
You know, it's tough because a lot of it is not from nearby. I mean, we have to have seafood on the menu. We went most of the summer without any salmon whatsoever, and I finally I gave in, and I'm buying wild salmon from Alaska, mm-hmm. which is wonderful.
It is. It's great.
So that's on our menu, and especially as a complement to tomatoes, it goes very well, mm-hmm. and with basil. So that's on our menu. We do a petrolli sole, which is
one of my favorite fish in the world.
So
that and sand dabs.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, after those two, there's not much else beyond.
You have to wait till late November for Dungeness crab.
That's right. Yeah,
and oysters.
Exactly. And we're doing a lot of shellfish and pastas and things like that. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. Well, back to slow food. The reason that I asked you here, Carlo Petrini is coming. Carlo Petrini, the founder of Slow Food. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about him coming and staying.
Well, he's been a guest in the past of Hotel Vitale. And I met him a number of years ago through Alice Waters and just sort of hit it off. He's really, you know, that great spirit that I think people think of. And, you know, through meeting him and cooking for him we just started, you know, hitting it off, and told me a little bit more. And I read his book, Slow Food Nation, and it was an idea that I liked very much. So through that, he's coming back for the Slow Food Nation. I'll be going to Italy for Terra Madre in October, which
tell people what Terra Madre is.
Well, Terra Madre is the event that Slow Food Nation is modeled after. From what I know, and I'm not an expert because I haven't gone, the Salone di Gusto, the nations of different cooks and farmers and academics get together and discuss food and food production. I'm going as a cook and will represent the Bay Area delegation. And there'll be lots of food and tasting and discussion and lectures about, a good, clean, and fair food system, which is what is at the heart of Slow Food Nation here coming up in San Francisco. So it's been a real education for me. I don't profess to be an expert. I just have more of a curiosity and an interest, and through meeting people, and again, meeting people at the dinner table, it sort of piqued my curiosity as somebody who could bring those things to where I work and where I cook. And so I'm looking forward to the adventure and the journey.
And again, the Slow Food Nation is taking place Labor Day weekend.
Yes, the Thursday, which I believe is the 28th.
29th, isn't it?
It's early this year. Labor Day is early.
And, yeah, I think Labor Day is on the...
Is the first.
Yeah. Yes, it's the first.
So, yeah.
28th, 29th, and 30th.
Yeah, at various locations around mm-hmm. the city. And
do you know where I found the website?
The website is slowfoodnation.org. And there's many different lectures and different sites where there's things taking place. And I'd urge listeners, if they have an interest in food and certainly about the future of food and how it's grown and raised, it would be great to a great place to come.
I think it's a good place to drag someone to who doesn't have an interest. If you're trying to wake somebody up,
well,
you can get a real concentrated hit if you don't come down.
Well, I think
most
there. People living in this part of California have an appreciation, so it's not hard to find people that that don't have that. What was surprising, and through the organizers, they felt that the interest would be mostly a local interest, and they're finding that people from all over the country are coming to the mm-hmm. event, which is great. And I think people will be surprised that San Francisco and the Bay Area is not the only place in the country that mm-hmm. has a real interest in this. And I think it's going to be hopefully something that when the event ends, it helps shape people's opinion when they return home, and maybe can incorporate some small changes.
Do some things.
And then for me, the whole point of it isn't absolute. I don't have an absolute answer for everything, but I try to inform myself and have an open mind and make small changes where I can in my own restaurant.
Mm. Now, have you been to the Victory Garden?
I'm waiting. I'm waiting till it sort of comes fully into uh-huh. bloom. So I would imagine in the next week or two, I'll make my way over there. But I've heard and seen pictures. It looks spectacular.
And are you able to do any sort of growing of anything?
At Americana, we don't. We probably could, but I think having that resource across the street has made
plaza.
Us maybe a little bit not jaded, but certainly lazy when it comes to doing our own. But no, we haven't done that. Mm.
Just curious.
Yeah.
We've got about 4 minutes left. And so one thing I'm curious about, do you get to go out to eat? Do you get to check out other restaurants in San Francisco much?
I wouldn't say much. Maybe once every other month. I'm probably having dinner. I had a wonderful dinner about a week or two ago at A16.
Oh, A16, one of my favorite places.
Just really great. I mean,
they've got a new cookbook coming out, too.
Yeah, that's what I heard. Nate is a fantastic chef, and Shelley, who does the wine program. It's just, it really is a wonderful restaurant. Delicious food, really great value. It's about San Francisco. I think people really, when you go in there, you really feel like it belongs in San Francisco. And it's the kind of food that I love to eat. So I ate there. And also, just in my own neighborhood, a new restaurant, Camino, which opened on Grand Avenue. And that's Russell Moore, who was with Chez Panisse for 20 years and had another fantastic meal there. That was about a month and a half ago.
Have you been to Qua?
I haven't been to Qua yet, and I would like to go. I know Daniel. I'm a co-chair for the Quesa event at the Ferry Building, their fundraiser, and he's done that event for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Really interesting guy, really dedicated.
Yeah. Well, I sort of feel like I discovered Daniel before anyone back when he was at.
Babette's, yeah.
And had one of the most amazing meals I've ever had. And it took another couple of years before people really started finding out about him. And then I saw that he got his fourth star
Best reviews I've
best
ever
review.
Read.
It was, Michael Bauer doesn't write love letters that often.
No,
and
I
this
agree.
Was a love letter.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I was very happy for him.
Yeah, I have not had a chance to get down there. I did Elizabeth Daniel several times.
Right.
The next one? Friesel?
Yeah, that's right, Friesel.
Yeah. Yeah, I never got there. He was there in the blink of an eye and
it seemed that way, yeah.
And I haven't had a chance to get to Qua, but I was very pleased to hear that Daniel had gotten what I'm sure is a well-deserved.
Right, well, he'll be around for Slow Food Nation. He'll be out and about, so, yeah.
Well, good. Any advice for people? We've got 2 minutes. What should people be doing if they just want to embrace this a little bit but don't have time to get down to Slow Food?
Well, I think it's a matter of making the effort to. It's about cooking for one. I mean, this movement is a lot about growing food, and I'm not on that end. I'm on the other end of cooking it. So, I think that the more people cook, and the more people that cook at home, who can share that with friends and family, that's what I would recommend. Hopefully, that's what people are attracted to when they live in this part of the country. It's certainly why I ended up here. And, cooking to me is such a personal thing that there, you don't have to have a perfect, recipe. I just think it's the act of cooking that is really the most important thing.
And you can let the four-year-olds crack the eggs. They are exactly. Old enough, and they love doing it. Okay, well, this has been a real luxury. Mouthfuls shows. The past several weeks have been very focused on a single topic, and I love just me, it's like a dinner table conversation to me.
Well, thanks
so this
for
has been
me.
Very much that sort of pleasure, Paul. So Paul Ehrenstam, executive chef for Hotel Vitale, an Americana restaurant. It is at 8 Mission in San Francisco, at the Embarcadero, and also one of the many chef volunteers for the upcoming Slow Food Nation. Have a great week, and meet me back here next Sunday at 7 for another episode of the One Country's Most Delicious Hour, Mouthful, here on KRCB.
Have you noticed that there's something a little odd about America's fascination with food? It's not just the Food Network and programs like this one or America's diet obsession. No fat, no carbs, no meat, raw food. It's almost like food has replaced religion as the moral center of people's lives, notes sociologist Barry Glassner in his book, The Gospel of Food, Why We Should Stop Worrying and Enjoy What We Eat, which has just come out in paperback. One of America's most interesting and pugnacious sociologists, Glassner urges a healthy skepticism about food claims of any sort. Most listeners will cheer his attack on spoil sports he calls the prophets of naught, those government nutritionists, scientists, and diet gurus who warn you off of eating anything that tastes remotely good. Red meat, butter, eggs, potatoes, French bread, and white sugar in all its wondrous forms. Glasner even digs up a couple of studies that show that people absorb more nutrients from food that tastes good and that they're told is good for them. In this light, making Americans afraid of almost everything they put in their mouths is a terrible idea. Be warned, however, that Glasner spends most of the gospel of food skewering sacred culinary cows at whose altars I, and probably you, regularly genuflect. The search for authenticity in ethnic food, for example, the health benefits of raw vegetables over meat, and the universal condemnation of fast food. For example, Glasner traces the increase in foodborne illness not to unhealthy practices in industrial slaughterhouses, but to the fact that Americans are eating more raw fruit and vegetables than ever before, a third more than we consumed in the 1950s. 50s housewives may have killed the flavor of food by cooking it to death, but they also killed the germs. And you know that famous and oft-quoted National Merit Scholarship study linking children's academic success to eating dinner together as a family every night? Glasner found it was an urban myth, a complete fabrication. No such study ever existed. Glasner's defense of fast food is even more intriguing. Fast food is regularly blamed for making Americans fat, but the fast food industry predated the obesity epidemic by a good 30 years, he notes. And Morgan Spurlock's Super Size Me notwithstanding, there has never been a single study definitively connecting eating in fast food restaurants with weight gain. The few studies that actually have been done show, much to everyone's surprise, that it makes absolutely no difference. And what's so great about being skinny anyway, Glasner challenges, bringing up that recent study showing that people who were slightly overweight outlived their skinny and even normal-sized peers. Glasner finds a fair amount of class bias at the root of today's culinary religion, and a gullible willingness to believe that we, the thin, the rich, the organically inclined, are saved, and that they, the poor slobs who eat, or worse, work at McDonald's, are damned. If you, like me, are tired of reading books that flatter you by telling you things you already know and only what you want to hear, the arrival of an in-your-face counterargument like the gospel of food is truly good news. This is Laura Hager for Mouthful.